What Now liberal scam. And now let's meet the panel. Here are writer, consultant, and TV political analysis. Sherman Singleton, political commentator and the host of and producer of YouTube's Secular Talk, Kyle Kalinske. Marcos Melissas, Sirius XM host, television commentator, and the former State Department official, Nera Hawk. A leading progressive voice, author, and CNN political commentator, Sally Cohn. Director of progressive programming for Sirius XM and political analyst for NBC, MSNBC, Zerlina Maxwell.
So much, I appreciate that. So, guys, we are going to have a very, very interesting and robust conversation with you. The title of this, of course, is What Now Liberals? I, being a conservative, will be just as fascinated as you guys to sort of hear from our panelists as we embark on this journey together. So, I want to start with Marcos, and then I want to just go down the line and get a response from everyone. So, we've all been hearing about the idea of a blue wave. There's a blue wave coming in November. Yet, when you look at history, according to PolitiFact, according to Forbes, the office of the president, the party of the president, I should say, typically loses around 32 seats. There's only been twice with FDR and George W. Bush where they actually gained seats. So a lot of people would wonder, is there really a blue wave, or what we expect to happen in November is just keeping in sync with historic precedent?
I think you're confusing blue wave with causation. I mean, there was going to be, by all indications, a blue wave. We've seen that in the run-up to this election, in the special election results. If you extrapolate Democratic performance before the general election to a special election and last year's November elections, that would put about 120 Republican House seats in play. Now, nobody's claiming that there are 120 in play, but we are at a point where you're looking at potential 50, 60 seats. We have our fundraising numbers, obviously, which are just unbelievable. Double up Republican fundraising in Q3. We just got the early vote numbers for first in Nevada last night, and they literally have doubled up from 2014 on that first day. They are almost at presidential level numbers. So this is Clark and Washoe County, Reno and Vegas. Washoe is actually a swing county, a 50-50 county, and Democrats are outperforming Republicans by 15 points in that early vote. All indications that there's going to be this massive wave. The fact that Trump is president absolutely is a factor. If Hillary Clinton was president right now, we'd be facing an apocalypse as Democrats, just by history.
Right, of course.
So Trump is a factor, but I mean, it's also a factor that Republican policies are incredibly unpopular.
Right, and we're gonna get to that.
Right.
We are gonna get to
and
that.
And they have been pushing that, and you know, McConnell's helping.
We only have an hour. Can we really get to it?
Well,
this is a lot of
cursory level.
So absolutely, I mean, there's a way. Trump is a factor, but Trumpism is also, I think, a factor that almost magnifies it by double.
So here, what's your take on this blue wave? Should we really expect it? I read a lot of analysts, and some folks are saying, well, be careful. Even David Axelrod said, Democrats should be careful not to overpromise this. He recently said a few weeks ago on CNN. What's your take?
Well, I think the numbers are going to get tighter and tighter, because that's just the nature of what happens when we get closer to Election Day. Even people who have left the Republican Party or left the Democratic Party often come back to home base, particularly in these types of elections. So watching out for that. And also watching out for not getting sucked into the brand name, right? And like Beto has become a brand name and has gotten many people excited around the country. But his actual registration numbers in Texas are worrisome. You don't have a Latino registration or Democratic registration there to be able to turn out the guaranteed votes. And so for someone like Beto, I think him even getting within 3 or 4 points of Ted Cruz is actually a win. That sets him up very well for the long term. So not thinking that it has to be all or nothing, and looking at a lot of these local races. At the end of the day, politics is local. It doesn't matter if somebody in New York, or sorry guys, here in LA, love a senator candidate, senatorial candidate from Texas, the people from Texas have to be the ones excited to charge up and to get on the vote. And that's what to look at, I think, for the midterms of 2020, is what kind of energy has gone into changing the electorate, changing the electoral map, and really building new party structures.
So Zerlina, Democrats only need 24 seats to be able to take the House. As Mayor just alluded, the race is getting tighter, significantly tighter. I think that's why you're beginning to see the president travel all over the place, really trying to gin up Republican voters to turn out, even though his name isn't on the ballot. However, there's a very interesting dynamic that Republicans may lose the House, but gain a seat or two in the Senate. We saw that happen before in 1962 with John F. Kennedy. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, this year is just a bad terrain for Democrats in the Senate. You have 10 states where Democrats are running for re-election, where Trump won just in 2016. And so, you know, that's not fun for Democrats to try to save seats in a state like Missouri or Tennessee, try to gain a seat, save a seat in Florida. But I do think that, you know, to piggyback off of what Marco said, this is a different moment. I just feel like this election is a little bit different than all the other elections. We always say it's the most important, but this is the one that feels like that actually is the truth, not just because of the policies that are impacting communities of color and marginalized people, but also because of climate change, and now we know we have a time limit in terms of when we can actually do something. So if we don't change the makeup of at least one branch of government in this election, we're going to head in the wrong direction for, you know, the foreseeable future, and that means clean air and clean water. So I just think there's so much at stake right now that this election feels more important than all of the others. And it's unfortunate that in the Senate we have such red terrain to challenge and try to at least keep the balance of power in the Senate at, you know, parity, right? Or try to keep it somewhat equal. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, yes, it's possible that Democrats could lose seats in the Senate and, you know, have a stellar performance in the House. I don't necessarily know that means that, you know, the Democratic Party is a message, or the Democratic Party as a whole has a problem. It's just now in this cycle we have, you know, tough terrain.
So, Kyle, obviously, Donald Trump is a very controversial person. I think we all agree to that. Do you think
controversial is a little bit nice?
I think so. Too nice.
I think. So, well, no. I think now, post 2016, we have to name it. He's not controversial. He's racist and sexist.
Well, I agree. So, let me ask you this: under the ordinary set of circumstances, the economy is doing well. Unemployment is significantly low. Most presidents would love to have an environment like this. Why is this not working for Trump?
I'm not so sure it's not going to work for Trump. I genuinely don't know what's going to happen, and that's why it's really interesting to follow politics now, because I'm not kidding when I say I think that Donald Trump is probably the greatest con man of all time. Yeah. I mean, sure that he's the greatest fake populist of all time. And you just said, unemployment's low, the economy's doing well. Actually, no, it's not. Just because the unemployment rate is low does not mean that wages are going up. In fact, wages are falling. So, Democrats, every single step of the way, have underestimated Donald Trump, and they never learn their lesson. So, It's scary to me, because you would think that, I mean, in all seriousness, if the Democratic strategists were doing their job properly, this wouldn't even be a conversation for the midterm. We would know it would be a blue wave. Unfortunately, I think Democrats are, you know, they go all in on Russia and the Mueller investigation. Go talk to somebody in the middle of the country. They're more like, I don't know, I don't want to pay my light bill and put food on the table. That's more important than the Mueller investigation. So I think Democrats going all in on the wrong things, and Donald Trump going around the country doing all of these rallies. I mean, I think every other president from here on out should steal that and go do rallies while they're in office, because that's a way to speak directly to the people. And when you do that, it actually works in the sense that, you know, he gets to scream fake news all day, and he's going to make his case better than anybody else. So as long as he keeps making his case, it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because I don't know what's going to happen in these midterms. I think that
Democrats probably will pick up seats, but not as much as everybody's predicting, because I just think he does a good job of doing what he's supposed to do, even though I despise him.
So, to Prado's point, do you think Democrats really are underestimating Trump and Trump voters going into November? And I ask that question because in November of 2016, no one thought Trump was going to win. Trump himself didn't even think he would win. Do you think it's a mistake to underestimate him, to Kyle's point, as we talk about this idea of blue wave?
I mean, obviously, it's a mistake. Look, he has, one of the things he has done is defied the conventional political gravity. Now, the question is, does he then remake the rules of this gravity, or does he... I think, this is a time of tremendous flux, and I always think it's wrong to underestimate. Sorry, guys, the coffee's
still going. That's good.
And I also think there's a danger in... Right, we've got to play the expectations game, there's a danger of saying, oh, automatic blue wave. And if you actually hear it, the Republicans are saying, blue wave, because they want to motivate their people. So I think we can't overstate anything or take anything for granted. Now, what I do think is interesting that's happening right now in midterms, and I think is poised to reshape politics, hopefully in a constructive way for the next generation, is that you're actually watching the Republicans really abandon their values, right? Mm-hmm. And try to back justify their embrace of Donald Trump. You know, I mean, if you go to the panels here, right, you're seeing it. It's people who despised Donald Trump and everything he stood for now embracing it. People who say, well, I don't like the way he says things, I don't like, right, but I love the policies he's giving us, right? And so you have a moment where conservatism, which I ideologically am opposed to, but had it, the sort of recent history of our country had come to stand for values, right, as sort of synonymous, are abandoning, morphing, and showing how influx of those values can be. And by the way, in interesting ways, although not consistent ways, right, we saw that Trump in the election was trying to mark himself as a pro-LGBT rights candidate, and in office is not going that way at all, as we've seen it again today. But you saw his voters say, yeah, we like that he's like a pro LGBT candidate. And you're like, what fucking Republican party is this? So that's interesting, right? And like similarly on trade, right? Like, listen, I'm going to say it. Like, there are aspects of his trade policy. If I had to rewrite NAFTA, I would have done some similar things. Not everything, but like the guy put an increase, a mandatory increase in minimum wage. In his free trade policy, that is antithetical to conventional Republicanism. And so you have, right, you have the Republicans trying to figure out, well, how can we contort ourselves to embrace this guy who seems to have this supernatural appeal and whatever, and at the same time wrestle with their moral concerns with some of the things you're doing. I think it's very encouraging to see so many Republicans, especially Republican women, conservative women, be appalled by Donald Trump separating families from the border. It is, in fact, appalling. And at the same time, what you're seeing is Democrats recommit to a set of core values. And there's a lot of talk, I think, about some of the ideologically different people running, but we find they're standing for something.
So that's
a positive point.
My next point. So let's say we make it through midterms. I don't want anyone of you guys to just jump into this question. We make it through midterms. Democrats, you guys, and I would argue as a Republican, should not make the same mistake Republicans did by having 15 candidates run for office. What's the message for the Democratic Party as they prepare to go into 2020?
I got that.
Go ahead.
Medicare for all. Free college, living wage, and the war.
Be normal and be human, right?
I know.
I agree with a lot of what you said. Some of what you said is the same thing. also think that the contrast needs to be more clear. It's what we stand for, yes, Medicare for all, but we also are not the party putting children into cages. And I think that that is actually the Democratic message, getting back to Sally's point. But I do think that what Sally said about core values is actually what this election, not just of 2018, but also in 2020 is about. And just to sort of contrast what you said about the 15 candidates, I actually think we need 15 candidates. I want 15 candidates to stand on the stage and tell me why I should support them. And I think that having a large array of candidates and a diverse set of policies that we can all debate, and you can boo me and you can debate it, and then we can make a choice and vote for the best.
First of all, it was a mistake to have 15 candidates since you have the White House.
Right.
It actually worked out.
Yeah.
So what mistake would you be making in that regard? We're going to have 22 right now. In my count, we're at 22, and we may have more.
Now,
serious candidates is a different story, right? But to me, you can talk about what the party message is, but it's utterly, utterly irrelevant. I mean, the Republican Party message used to be national security, right? He's bought by the Russians. It used to be family values. Like the most morally degenerate asshole in American history. Right? So, it doesn't happen. Okay, we got that.
And the deficit, don't forget the deficit.
So, that was the part of the message. He came in and said, I'm the message. We're going to have somebody who's going to end up as a nominee, whether it's Elizabeth Warren, whether it's Kamala Harris, probably one of those.
Bernie
Sanders.
Doesn't mean I'm some center shill. You're making many assumptions about that. But I was a feminist. obligation to provide treatment.
So we obviously see that there are some slight differences within the party as far as how to tackle Trump. Could that be something that played to Trump's favor as far as winning re-election?
Absolutely, we eat our own.
If the base ends up shouting down women of color because they need to win more than they need to be supportive, that will ultimately be a problem for the Democratic Party. Yes.
The only point I want to make is that I think the only tool, and I happen to agree with them, that the best way to defeat Donald Trump in the year 2020 is with Bernie Sanders.
In order for Bernie Sanders to win the Democratic primary, he's going to have to get women who look like me to show up and vote for him.
They recently changed that because a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters were not very happy with how the system, they thought the system was against Bernie Sanders.
The superdelegate having a vote was absolutely a problem for the party. It was a problem in 2008 when Hillary Clinton dragged out the primary with Obama had the mathematical lead with actual earned delegates, and she hoped that the superdelegates were gonna bail her out. Same thing happened in 2016. There's some sort of poetic justice in there, I guess. But after railing against superdelegates, Bernie stuck in the race after he was mathematically eliminated because he thought the superdelegates were going to bail him out. I mean, it was apparently observed from the beginning. But the media only has these charts, and he put in the superdelegates, and it skews what the total numbers were. So I love the fact this compromise that they came up with, which basically says that they don't get a vote in the first round unless it's by acclamation.
I'd eliminate them. Get rid of all the superdelegates.
It's easy to sit in a room and boo the party, right? So the superdelegates are people who are burnt us in their ass for the party. They're doing the job of getting people, getting candidates recruited, helping get them funded, having an organized party. These are people who give their heart and soul to the party. Now, you may disagree with them, but they get a say in how the party runs. And here's the beauty of it. You guys can do the work, too, and you can be a superdelegate. But you can't say it.
Show up to vote the same way that Republicans show up to vote. We got to get it together, register, turn out, and show up. You don't have to love every single thing about the candidate. You have to just show up. Republicans are wonderful about getting in line. We demand that we have to have the love and ultimate respect of our people. This entire concept of I can't vote for the lesser of two evils, guys, it's a binary choice. It's a binary choice at the end of the day. That's going to be a cultural challenge that we face as Democrats. It's how do we actually turn out our people in 2020 when there has been bad blood prior to that?
Are those people who are negatively impacted by these policies? I mean, that's my focus every day when I wake up. It's not like Bernie Sanders or who's going to be in 2020 the candidate and who's going to inspire me. It's actually the children in the cages. It's actually the women on the border who are being raped.
Are you growing children in the cages?
And so for me, it's actually about the people who are. Don't talk over me.
If you
don't want to hear us talk,
seriously.
Speak over me. But the point is that I actually feel really deeply about the marginalized communities that are impacted by these policies. And so, yes, I will vote for Bernie Sanders if that means that that's the person that's going to be Trump, because I actually care about the marginalized people. It's not just about, like, supporting my guy. It's actually because I care about people, and that's why I am a progressive. That's why I thought we're all here. If it's not there, Democratic Party has not just been, and I agree, I believe that the Democratic Party, because of its historic elite, big bank, Wall Street, big business friendly policies, has abandoned the white working class. Yeah. But let me be clear. Wait, hang on. Can I make my damn point? Thank you. Like those are the only voters who matter. And then you only legitimately win an election if you win a majority of white people. Now let me tell you, that is not only true, but that is not future politics. And the Democratic Party, including, by the way, some of those candidates who we're talking about now, have ignored appealing to, valuing, treating seriously women, people of color, and immigrants as the future of the Democratic Party. Because there's some sense, what I'm saying is an implicit white supremacy of a sense that we are a less legitimate party if that is how we win, which, by the way, is racist and it's bullshit. So, now, let me also say, I'm sorry, but this is not how we treat one another. And part of the problem is, I'm going to say this, part of the problem is that those same working class white folks feel like y'all are mean and condescending to them, right? Just like you're being mean and condescending now. And that is not who we should be. And there is a problem in this country, and I will tell you, it is true in my experience, that Democrats and liberals are nicer to humanity in general and our policies and our principles, but we are mean to people in particular. And you know what? Conservatives can be really nice to people in particular, even though they are mean to humanity in general. So you know what? You want people to actually vote for your candidate? Then you know what? Appeal to them. Don't just be mad at them that they don't see the world the way you do. Actually make an effort.
The reason I interjected is because I feel like the policies of the Democratic Party should be for working people, full stop. So there's this notion that, if you're fighting for the working class, you're only fighting for the white working class. I actually think that's really condescending towards people of color who are working class, because these policies that we talk about that the Democratic Party should be in favor of, like Medicare for All and free college and a living wage and ending the wars and ending the drug war and a new New Deal, these are good for all working people. So
offensive to people of color. I'm asking.
No, because I'm not saying you did this on purpose. That's why I interjected, because I didn't think you meant it when you said, oh, it's all about the white working class. My point was, it's about the working class.
Wait, can I defend my point? My point is that when we only enumerate, when we say working class, in practice, the way that the Democratic politics play out is we actually treat the white working class as the way they matter. Right. But I think it's the Democratic way. I'm being very explicit.
That's how the Democratic Party speaks about it, not how she.
But I'm not saying, for instance, that Medicare for All doesn't actually hurt. Medicare for All helps working women, working white men, people of color, immigrants. It helps everyone. The problem is that Democrats have historically, for the last 34 years, acted as though the group they have to win over, the group they have to sell it to, and therefore the only group that they talk about, care about, and speak to, are de facto, without even naming it, the white working class.
So,
that's what I'm talking about.
So let me ask you guys this question. We have seen the recent data that a significant percentage of middle-class white women are starting to abandon the Republican Party. As we talk about how the Democratic Party should form their message going into midterms and beyond, is there room for disaffected Republicans? Folks who say, you know what, I cannot stick with the Republican Party under Trump. Is there room for those types of voters in the Democratic Party going forward? Marcos?
Michael Cohen, you can keep that guy. We don't want him. White working class women, if you look at the polling, is the single movable demographic right now, in suburban specifically. Mm-hmm. And they look good in the polling in 2016, and they ended up voting with their husband. One little fact is that single women are 60-40 Democratic, married women are about 55-45 Republican. And it doesn't matter if you're never been married, divorced, or widowed. So when you get married, a woman becomes more conservative. If she is a widow or divorced, she reverts and becomes more Democrat. So they are a movable demographic. They didn't come through for the Democrats in 2016. When I look at the possibility of a wave, if these white, white suburban Republican women, if they stick with the polling and they vote Democratic, we're seeing massive, massive gains. If not, we're seeing moderate gains. That's like the big factor as far as I'm concerned. So I hope that we're getting them. I mean, there's definitely room for them. I mean, these are people who they're not the racist, Trumpian base. These are educated women who are struggling with a lot of things.
But if they were to beg the question, and Sally mentioned this 3 months ago, there are some things about the Democratic message that I like, but I don't feel accepted. I do feel that the message is sort of mean to people who don't sort of follow this script of what it means to be a progressive or a Democratic socialist, or just a Democrat by and large. What do you say to those people, like a purity test?
Yeah, purity politics is going to be a problem for the party going forward. It really is, right? We have extremists in the left, there are extremists on the right. We need to be able to turn back to a time when we were the big tent. Right? But diversity is about a big tent, multiple ideas, moving forward in a general direction. And I think, frankly, setting the compass for normal, moral, and not treasonous is actually a win right now. You don't really have to do much more than that to be an alternative to Donald Trump and to welcome some of the thinkers, the conservative thinkers, into the party fold.
I also think that black women are an emerging demographic group. Women of color are a demographic group that vote in frequently in elections at all levels. And we're a voting bloc that needs to be paid attention to. And I know that it's possible, frequently we're not listened to, or they only come to you the 3 weeks before the election to sort of get you to turn out. I worked on the campaign. I know what happened there. So a lot of the messages that people think that we should have been saying, those people like me were on the inside actually making the argument for that. But I do think that the Democratic Party, in order to win, we have to focus on the voters that actually win elections, and we don't do that. We focus on tangential things. Getting back to being normal and not treasonous is true, but if we actually focus on the demographic groups that win elections, we would actually win them.
I think it's about populism. The original question was, hey, can we win over, the moderate Republican vote? I think it's about populism, because when you look at the polls, you find that a lot of these issues we would typically consider, like far-left issues, they're actually very mainstream issues. So raising the minimum wage, for example, 80% of the American people want to raise the minimum wage. And I think that populism cuts across party lines, and it makes it so that you can really build bridges and have not just victories, but overwhelming victories for what would typically be considered far-left policies.
Dichotomy here, and if there's one thing I actually do hope Democrats learn from Donald Trump is, look, the guy is not afraid to fight for what he wants that appeals solely to his base, even though he is doing horrific, immoral, and unpopular things. He does not care. Now, meanwhile, you have Democrats who support things that are overwhelmingly popular. Right, we have some disagreements around the edges, and those are important. And the majority of what constitutes the left politics, wildly popular, both with the base and with those three swing voters. And we fucking cave all the time. I mean, look at the Democrats recently making a deal, say, oh, we're gonna work with the Republicans to get a few of your judicial nominees through under the hopes that you then don't do anymore, and then the Republicans turn around and screw them and pass more and lay them down. The sick irony is they're not afraid to stand for something and people don't like what they stand for. We're afraid to stand for something and people actually like what we stand for.
Persuade them. Why don't we actually try to turn out the people who already support us? I just think that that's an easier way to do it.
So let's move to my next question for you guys. We talk about diversity, African Americans, Hispanics. So Donald Trump received around 35% of the Latino vote. There are some political scientists that argue if he would have received anything less, he probably would not have won. When you think about those numbers, people of color voting for someone like Trump, what can Democrats do to bring those people back to their side? That's what anyone.
Yeah, I would argue there's, in 2016, there were 92 million voting eligible Americans who did not turn out and vote. I would probably guess about 65% of those are Democratic-leaning constituencies. We have this enormous pool of people. That 35% of Latinos, they want to vote for Trump.
The largest block was non-voters. So how do we get those people engaged? That's fundamentally what we did in the Obama campaign. I mean, America elected a black president as part of that campaign, and I was still surprised, because we changed the map, right? You change the map, and that's not something that you do just on election day. You have to have those investments years out to be turning out your base, reaching your base, but also bringing more people to
vote. But how do you do that? How do you mobilize your base and target and mobilize new voters when every single day the news is Trump, Trump, Trump? When people say, you know what, I'm just sick of politics.
You ignore the news. The news cycle is actually just an ecosystem that we are all participants in, and we, you know, talk about whatever tweet happened in the morning, but people are living their lives day to day. People are dealing with issues day to day, and they're dealing with health care crises and medical bills and, you know, poor education and housing. And so there are issues that are in people's faces every day when they wake up, and that's what this is about. I mean, fundamentally, this moment is so hard for me because I feel like politics has become a spectacle. And this is about policy and people. And I think that we've lost that. And we're so into, like, applause lines and cheering and booing and, like, being a part of a team and having a color and wearing a jersey. And then being like, I don't like you because I'm on this side. And I just think that this is so much more important and bigger than that. And I think that we need to get back to that.
Continue to vote overwhelmingly for the Democratic Party, and a lot of African Americans believe there are issues that are not fully addressed, criminal justice reform, police brutality. How can or what do Democrats need to do to address those concerns so that African Americans can say, you know what, not only am I going to vote Democratic, but I'm going to go out and make sure others do the same?
No, that's a really good question, and I think it's a hard question, because a lot of these issues are systemic and, you know, cultivated over decades. And so you have Democratic politicians who have 4-year, 8-year terms who don't have an incentive to implement policies that won't be enacted, you know, for 10 to 12 years, or changes won't happen far beyond when they're out of office. You see this in Chicago with Rahm Emanuel, who I do not support and who I have a lot of problems with because, you know, there are problems that were basically caused by policy after policy, tearing down the projects, moving the gang members into the same neighborhood. So you hear about gun violence in Chicago, but you don't necessarily know why it is the way it is right now. And so that's because of political choices made in the short term and not thinking about the long term, and because those people don't care about those communities.
Those people don't really care about the people who live there. They care about their re-election. And so I think in terms of holding Democrats accountable, it's absolutely true that, you know, Democratic politicians have made a lot of promises and not necessarily delivered, not just on the local level, but all the way up. You know, I have my issues with Obama, who I worked for in 2008. But I do think that the bottom line is that, you know, you have to get in the game. You actually have to put skin in the game. So if you see the Democratic Party and you see problems within the party, get involved with the party. You infiltrate and change from within. That's what I believe. And so, you know, I couldn't sit back and watch a Hillary Clinton campaign and see that there were issues or ways in which I could add value and sit back and not do anything. So I decided to jump into the campaign and then be the perspective talking about criminal justice, be the perspective talking about reproductive justice and the Hyde Amendment, which actually did push Bernie to the left on the Hyde Amendment specifically in the primary, because that's something that I care about as a woman of color, because women of color can't don't have affordable access to reproductive health care in many instances, and it's because of the Hyde Amendment, and that matters. So I think that, you know, in terms of what the Democratic Party can do and how black people can actually feel like they're being listened to and heard, part of that is we have to get in it. We can't just be on the outside yelling or booing. We have to get involved, and we have to be engaged as citizens. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to, you know, be the campaign manager, but it does mean that you're going to try to put some skin in the game.
So, guys, we're going to open it up for a Q&A. So, before we go to Q&A, let me just be very, very clear on this. Just, guys, please listen. I want you to just state your first name and your question, not a commentary, or I will ask you to move on, because there's a lot of people who need to ask questions. Go ahead, sir.
Only one question. Kanye is talking about running for Senate from California. How powerful will Kanye be in picking up the youth vote and the African American vote?
Not at all. You actually have to know things.
Go ahead.
Kyle, I've heard that you were willing to debate Ann Coulter. You were all excited, and she backed out.
Yeah.
That's lame, but I work for Jesse Lee Peterson, and I've tried to get you on the show like five times. Sally did it.
You do this every year, man. All right, let's see what else.
Would you be willing to debate him?
Not only that, I floated a debate with him when Ann Coulter backed out, and he said no.
Oh!
Feminist, anti-white, pro-open borders, brown police. Because I think a red tsunami is coming if you guys continue this.
Alright, keep believing that.
I didn't hear a question. Because if I can win with that, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I can win with that because I can do math. And we have an emerging majority of people of color is the future of this country. And I also think that if we actually got rid of voter suppression, we would have won in 2016.
Can we future-proof the post office to compete with, like, Amazon and...
I just got a flyer, and somebody handed it to me, and basically the idea is, like, let's have banking at the post office.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful idea. Yeah. You know, we can use mandatory banks to give people a better option.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
I understand the entire panel. You were just saying that Republicans just fight, and they stick by whatever their message is. They fight, and they duke it out, and they win. How can Democrats start to do that? Because you used to be the party that used to do that, FDR, President Roosevelt said, I grew up under Adrian, and he kept doing it because he stood by with my good progressive values.
Yeah, I think we could vote that. I mean, I think we have to be honest about the Democratic Party and that we're a coalition of voters, and we're going to have a divergent, you know, series and sets of values and opinions on policy, and that is okay.
fantastic.
Yeah, I think the fact that the recommendation for the presidential, and there's so many candidates, it's going to have to be these incredibly progressive policies. And I think the fact that people are now funding Democratic campaigns as opposed to corporate PACs dramatically changes the equation. Now those elected officials are dependent on the small dollar donors to keep them going, and they're going to have to be responsible.
And it's understanding why Republicans got in line with Donald Trump. He gave him lower taxes, he gave him judicial nominees, and he's going to try to overturn abortion, right? So a very, very discreet, target, high-level agenda, and appeal to the emotion of the personality, right? Like, we've got to get a little bit away from having to love every single person we vote for, and actually just vote for the people and the policies.
Thank you. Here's where I'm going to say something for your Bernie supporters. One of the reasons I liked Bernie supporting into the primary is I thought what he did for the Democratic Party in getting the party to stop pulling punches on the things we support, but actually just say, I believe in this. Again, like, there are lots of things, and you know, I think we still have a big test for it, but there are a lot of things that those dissident voters will come in that we should be loyal on the policies that we support as Democrats because they help all people, but especially because they help communities of color. Like, we have backed away from those things, and then we allow space to be taken up, like, well, suddenly they're anti-white because the Republicans are attacking us more than we're defending ourselves and standing up for those beliefs. And that's a problem, and I think it's because we're afraid to actually be the party we are, which is the party of everyone, but especially the party that is led by and for and foregrounds the communities who are most left out in this country. And I think that there's pride in that and there's power in that.
Hi, I'm Sean. My question is, what are some big loser issues for Democrats? What are often focused on by candidates that are actually detrimental to their campaigns?
The House candidate should not be running on impeachment right now. Monolocal issues. Show that you are the person who speaks for your people, again, in a normal, not corrupt way. That's a very easy path to victory right now.
I agree with that. I think that not just House candidates, but all candidates, because impeachment is a two-step process. You need 218 votes in the House, and you need 67 votes in the Senate to actually remove the president from office. I'm not saying that there's no justification for it. You know, a lot of investigations should be win back the House. But if we impeach the president, say we just win the House back, and we impeach the president, he's still the president. So I don't know if that's where we should be spending all of our energy, because again, his engages. So what are we going to do in the short term to get those kids out of the cages, maybe get some of those folks back with their parents, because the divorce will be separated, and that keeps me up at night. And I think that that's where our focus should be, and not...
I agree with both those points, and I'll just add, and I know some people might disagree with this, but I don't think they should focus on Russia.
But nobody is.
You guys agree?
No candidate.
You're right. I haven't seen
much of campaign. We're talking about
Russia. The Republicans are framing the Democrats as though they're running on Russia, but it's actually not that.
You're right.
You're right.
Go ahead, man.
And policy.
Yeah. So my name is Sina. I'm a person of color, obviously. And my family voted for Bernie Sanders. We all supported him. And my question was just that, obviously, racial justice issues and social issues are tremendously important, especially to me. But why can't we all unite under economic issues, things like higher wages and Medicare for all, stuff like that? Because we do have racial issues on one side, but don't those economic issues benefit all of us as a whole?
The challenge is recognizing that there are systemic issues that connect race and economy.
I don't know. Can we, like, define intersectionality for a moment?
Yeah.
Because everything that you just said is an economic issue. Social justice and racial justice are economic issues. You know, lower wages, discrimination, those things impact people's pocketbooks, right? And they impact their ability to be upwardly mobile. And if you have poor education, you actually can't self-determine. If you don't have access to reproductive health care, again, an economic issue. As a woman, which is more than half of the population, if you don't have access to affordable reproductive health care or all the full slate of choices, including abortion, you can't self-determine. You can't do anything. And so I feel like what you said is absolutely true, but there needs to be a more explicit message that shows that all those issues intersect. And intersectionality is actually where we need to be going in terms of a party. And I know that you said that feminism is a bad thing, but all that means is that I'm equal to you. I'm here. Because just to articulate what feminism is, it means women are people deserving of equal rights. It is an economic issue when you're being discriminated against. If you can't get fair wages, that is an economic issue. And maybe that's because of your racial identity, right? So I think all of these issues are connected.
There's a historic divide on the sort of center left between, and this is true of the activist left as well, actually, between a community of people who say, look, if we just fix the economy, we fix everything. And then there's a community of people who say, you know, actually, we've tried to do that at various points in time, but because we did not attend to the way in which economic justice affects different communities differently and overlaps and intersects with other kinds of systemic and, like, built-in inequalities, race, gender, etc., then it didn't work, right? So when we look at the aspects of the New Deal, that made huge, that were huge, and overall had a positive effect and were progressive, but because of how certain communities were locked down, didn't help communities of color, right? Same thing with, returning college grants for returning vets, et cetera. The way Social Security was calculated and how that affected women who didn't work outside the home. Like, you can't, right? So it's not saying, and this is the problem, and this is why I think the Democrats really fuck ourselves over, because we are afraid to talk about how, look, things that help, like, that we're afraid to talk about race and gender, et cetera, in ways that don't feed into this narrative. We don't know how to, right? It suggests that we're actually picking each other, but we're not. We're making sure. This is really John Powell stuff, right? This is saying, like, everybody go read Professor John Powell, that what you actually have to do is when you're devising policies and you're developing policies, you look at the communities that are worse off now, and you make sure that your solutions are helping them, and therefore will help everyone, which we know time and time again is actually the way it works. That is the policy mission. I know we don't talk about policy anymore on the left, but hey, that's the actual policy.
We are currently in a world where we just, it's a given the Democrats are going to win, have like a 7-8 point edge in basically any election, and it's still a 50-50 of how things are going to go because of gerrymandering, because of the Electoral College, because the Senate is a fucked up thing from slavery. And so, why is it so hard? The Republicans have no problem cheating to win. You've got it in Georgia, you've got it in North Dakota, it's everywhere. Why are we so afraid of saying, hey, when we win, we're going to fix this shit so it doesn't happen? That seems so
easy. I mean, part of it, because some of that requires constitutional amendment. But there's a big movement towards statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico. Yeah. And we're going to go back to that. We're going to have the
D.C. has the same number of electoral votes.
Half the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
half the Supreme Court.
So,
just preposterous, and I feel like we sit back and let Trump and his rallies just run roughshod and say preposterous things. So I think step one is laugh at that, mock it, check it, and make sure the media is doing their job. Because unfortunately, I think the media will take little sound bites of something salacious or silly he says, and that becomes the news story for 24 hours, as opposed to the 56 factually incorrect policy things Trump said were lies, and they just kind of let that go.
So, guys, we have 5 minutes. I just wanted to get some quick closing remarks from everyone. Sally, we can start with you.
Yeah, I'm being called way over there. I just want to say on the when they go low, we go high, it's really interesting because I feel like Democrats, the left, writ large, when Michelle Obama said it, and we thought we were going to win, we were all for it. And then when we lost, suddenly we're like, well, that was a fucking bad idea.
Because it seems like that kind of is an issue that some Democrats are having in terms of being able to answer.
Well, it saves money, so I always find this conversation a little silly. Because it's like, the real question is, how can we afford to do what we're doing right now?
Quickly, that would be the biggest sort of source of corporate welfare in American history. As a company myself, as a business owner, I would love to get healthcare costs off my books. So that would be incredibly stimulating. And then,
really quickly, we've got to wrap up.
Okay. You guys alluded to embracing democratic populism as a strategy, but populist preferences are generally pretty unstable. So, how do you actually establish a sustainable policy platform for the party?
You stick with the basic principles of we actually want to do good by people and we're willing to have a debate of ideas instead of a debate of the better. That's the cultural piece of it.
Guys, thank you so much. Thank you.